Hey, Trisha Griffith here. I am the very proud owner of WebSleuths.com, and we have an officially jam-packed Web Sleuths podcast for you. A little bit later on, we'll talk with Donna Kaufman about the tragedy of the family annihilator. I'm talking about the Hart family, and Donna has all of the inside scoop. We'll wrap up the show with a very uplifting interview with Dr. Lillian Glass. She's now a documentary filmmaker. She made a movie about her mother, Reinventing Rosalie, and it's already winning awards. But first, the big news, the capture of the Golden State Killer, also the East Side Rapist, and about a million other names, and the guy that lives right there where it all happened, he knows all the case players, is Mark Klass, our good friend from the Klass Kids Foundation. So we start out the interview with, of course, the big news, the capture of Joseph James D'Angelo.
Mark Klass, you are right there in the thick of all of this, of the East Side Rapist and the Golden State Killer. This guy, Joseph D'Angelo, wasn't on anybody's radar that I'm aware of. And the police and DA, they're being very cagey. They're not saying how the DNA came into play. They're just saying they are using the latest technology in DNA to capture him. Mark, you, like I said, you're kind of right in the thick of things. Have you heard anything? How they found this guy's DNA in the first place and connected it to these cases?
Well, listen, here's what this guy is connected to. Joseph James D'Angelo is a 72-year-old white ex-police officer living in Citrus Heights, California, which is a Sacramento suburb. He's wanted for 45 rapes and 12 murders in California from 1976 to 1986. During that time, he is also thought to have burglarized hundreds of homes. He was known not only as the East Area Rapist and the Golden State Killer, but he was also the original Night Stalker, the Diamond Knot Killer, and the Visalia Ransacker. So what this guy did is he went on various crime sprees around the state of California. He started in 1976 up in Sacramento, and then in 1979 he moved his operation down to Southern California. And over the course of this time, there were similarities in a lot of the crimes. The Diamond Knot is a similarity. And there was also a lot of MOs that were that was very similar during this whole time. And it really took them many, many years to be able to tie these various crime scenes together. And then in 2016, the FBI reopened the case and offered a large reward for information. Then, just recently, Michelle McNamara, the deceased wife of Patton Oswalt, wrote a book, and they published her book just a couple of weeks ago. And this continued to put pressure on it. Where the final tip came from, I have absolutely no idea. But I do know many of the people involved. I'm a good friend of Anne Marie Schubert, who is the Sacramento County DA, and Greg Totten, who's the Ventura County DA. And I know that these are very no-nonsense people who wouldn't have taken a step like this unless they were 100% certain that they had the right man.
Exactly. Well, we've heard rumors, and you know me, I'll take rumors. If that's all I got, I'll take it. But here's what we've heard. We've heard that it was an old DNA kit from a rape that was finally tested against the DNA that they had against that was provided by the victims. We've heard that it was a family member that came in and offered their DNA to be tested against the crime DNA. So there's all different types of rumors going around, but I just think it's interesting that they're not coming out and saying it right now. But the good news is this guy has been caught. He's off the street. I don't know if he's been active lately, but at least he's going to get justice, right?
There have been no crimes tied to him since 1986, as far as I know. But I think the big question is what even put them in his direction?
Right.
He didn't submit DNA to them. He didn't give them any DNA at all. You know?
Exactly.
They like a TV procedural, they followed him around and extracted DNA from something that he might have thrown away or touched. or something along those lines. And then that's when they were able to match this individual to all of these crimes. Now, how they were alerted to him, as you said, that a family member, somebody in his family may have been suspicious, and they might have been able to use mitochondrial DNA to connect.
Well, I'm sure everybody's breathing a sigh of relief, even though, like you said, he seems he hasn't been active since 1986. But I'm sure you've heard the victims talking today, the ones that survived. And boy, are they elated. They're happy. It warms your heart to see those people finally get some semblance of justice, that this guy is going to get his. And you know that feeling. It's bittersweet.
You know, listen, I do. Here's the thing with this guy, though. He is one of the most prolific and horrific criminals in the history of our country, certainly in California. And there's plenty of company in California.
Mm-hmm.
And every place this guy touched, he would bring down a reign of terror on that community until he stopped committing those crimes. I mean, seriously, 45 rapes, 12 murders, and burglarizing hundreds of homes. What he would do is he would go in and he would flash his flashlight in the eyes of the victims to temporarily blind them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something he did time after time after time after time, which is, again, one of the things that they were able to use to help bring all of these together.
Exactly, to help to help tie him together to all of those. And there may be some that we don't even know about yet that we'll be finding out about. But, Mark, we'll be checking back in with you in the days to come. So hopefully you'll make yourself available and you won't be blocking my calls, because I'll be calling you 10 to 12 times a day probably. So,
oh, great. Anytime, Trisha, anytime at all. I'll take your call. You know that.
Oh, I love you. Give my love to Violet, too, okay?
All right. All right.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
That was Mark Klass from the Klass Kids Foundation, a very good friend of Web Sleuths. My name is Tricia Griffith, and I do apologize. You heard some buzzing in that last interview, and I finally found out the problem in my podcast with the buzzing. It's demons from hell. Yeah, literally demons from hell in my house while I do my podcast, so I will do my best to get rid of them. In the meantime, we're going to turn now to Donna Kaufman. Donna Kaufman is a true crime author. She's an investigative reporter, an incredible journalist, and she knows all about the Hart family tragedy.
On the phone with me now is Donna Kaufman. Donna Kaufman, a good friend of Web Sleuth. She's an author, an investigative reporter, former writer for Saturday Night Live, and co-author of the book Final Exams, True Crime Cases of Sarah Weck. Welcome back, Donna Kaufman. We love having you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tricia. And Web Sleuthers, thank you for letting me come on the show and talk about this case.
Well, we love you. And I love having you on, but I hate the topics that we need to discuss, and this one in particular.
Yes,
Jennifer Jean Hart and Sarah Margaret Hart, both 38. They were married. They had six adopted kids, and their minivan was purposely driven off a cliff in Washington State. Three children are still missing, presumed dead. And, Donna, I'll be honest with you. I usually get into all of the cases and try and find out as much as I can. I can't begin to get into this. I get so upset. I can't get that vision out of my mind. Those kids, the van pulled up to the cliff and stopped. Can you imagine the terror those children felt? And what's so frustrating, Donna, is there were signs all along that these two women should never have had these children. And Donna, you are truly one of a dying breed of investigative reporting. You get the facts that nobody else can get, and I know you have been working on this story for many, many days now, but start from the beginning. Give us all the details. I'll do my best to not burst out crying.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a pretty tough cookie. I read autopsy reports and look at crime scene pictures day in and day out. And this case has just sort of taken my breath away. And I find myself going through the last several days of just deep depression and a need to know more. And, of course, at the beginning, you know, I was like any investigator would say, well, listen, maybe she had a heart attack. Maybe mm-hmm. she had a stroke and floored it and it went over. give us something more that shows us this was a purposeful act. And I watched on the Ashley Banfield show, she interviewed the sheriff every single day, and you could see that the case was coming together. And if you've ever seen Law and Order, what they do when they're trying to puzzle through something, you put a blackboard up, and you say, here are the things that lead us to think that this was a purposeful act. Here are the mitigating points that make us think maybe it was an accident, and then all of a sudden it starts taking shape. Now, I'll just back up a little and give you some basic details. I know you know them, but for the listeners, this happened on the 26th of March, which was a Monday. In the afternoon, a German couple was on the cliffs overlooking Mendocino, which is in California, not too far from the Oregon border. And they looked over and they saw a SUV toppled over on its roof. And it was, they called it in, and the police went down there and found bodies inside. They found two Caucasian women and three black children. And they found out, they ran the license, found out that this was the Hart family. Jennifer and Sarah have been together for 18 years. They adopted six black children from foster care in Texas. The first, Marcus, Hannah, and Abigail, 19, 16, and 14, came in 2006. And 3 years later, almost 3 years later, Jeremiah, who died at 14, Sierra, 15, and Devontae died at 15, came from the second foster care situation. Devontae, we all remember a photo of him during the Ferguson riots. There was a photo of this beautiful young black teen hugging a white police officer in Portland, Oregon, and it went around the world. This is a sign of peace. This is, Black Lives Matter and everyone matters, and we can be peaceful together. And it was just a wonderful photo. Well, that's Devontae. Now, in the car was a 2003 GMC SUV, and if you've seen these, they have seating for eight people, and they have windows all the way around. The back window kind of wraps around. It's a huge vehicle. And all of the, as cops were taking the bodies out of the car, they noticed that all the windows were broken. The car must have bounced on its way down 70 to 100 feet off the cliff. And all the windows were broken out. Some of the doors were taken off. Some of the doors and parts of the car were on that cliff. But down at the bottom, near the ocean, was this car. And so then the question became, well, where are the other three children? There are three children not in this car. So a few days later, a black female teenager's body showed up. It's in, a few miles away. It's presumed that's one of the two sisters who was missing. And there were some really harsh winds and waters there. So since we don't know when that car went over and how long the children were exposed to the people inside, the bodies were exposed to the ocean tides, they could have been out to sea. I believe that they all perished in that car, and I believe they will be found. So the cops start looking backwards and figuring out, well, what is this? Who is this family? And they determined that they went to the house where they lived in Washington, in a city very close to the Oregon border on the other side of Oregon. the north side of Oregon, very close to, in Washington, there was a 2-acre home that the women got and lived in with their children. And at night house, they have chickens, they have cats and dogs. The cats, dogs, ducks were all in the home. What was missing, they had 2 or 3 dogs. So did they take the dogs in the car with them? Who knows? It's not reported that they gave the dogs to anyone. So that could be what happened too. So anyway, they do autopsies on the family, and then you could see that the sheriff was saying this is a purposeful act. So that tells me, autopsy girl, that they did not find a stroke, a heart attack, or anything from the driver who was Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
No one in the, it was misreported at the beginning that that the parents were wearing seatbelts and the kids weren't. In fact, nobody in that car was wearing a seatbelt. The sheriff has gone on television many times. And by the way, if you want to follow this case on Facebook, go to the Mendocino Sheriff Facebook page. Mendocino is the community, and the sheriff, you can contact him, sheriff@mendocinosheriff.com, Tom Allman, Allman. And the phone, they're hoping for tips, 707-463-4411. Because as the sheriff has said, you know, there were no suitcases in this car. There, mm-hmm. We don't understand how they got here, what they were doing here, how long were they gone. We believe that they probably left on Friday, but nobody is sure because nobody saw them go. It's kind of a rural community, and they were minding their own business all the time, so no one really took note of that. But, you know, they had to have stopped for food or
somewhere,
at least to fuel their car. So did it, but nobody has called and said, yeah, I saw those people, a very unique group of people, I might add, stopping at a mini mart and fueling up their car. The sheriff really needs to have some feedback from the public who might have seen something, even the most mundane kind of sighting could be helpful in establishing a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, the sheriff swallowed hard and said, listen, this is this was a purposeful act. Now, was, you know how when you're a parent, you know one teenager can drive you nuts.
Yes.
6 teenagers here.
I can't imagine.
And then, you know, it could have just been, would you guys shut up? And then what we know, the day before, in the morning of the day before the car was found, so we're talking about Sunday morning, the car found Monday afternoon, Jennifer Hart, who was the driver, established that. I guess they did DNA testing on the steering wheel, whatever, fingerprints, whatever. They know that she was the driver. She stopped in a Safeway store and grocery store and bought bananas. She was on a surveillance camera. So that's the last bit of timeline that we have, and that happened south of where the car went over the cliff. That means that if this happened shortly thereafter, she was driving northward, which means this part of the street was a 4-lane road, 2 in each direction. So at some point she pulls over to the to the turnout, and what we know is then she floored it and went over the cliff. So she went over 4 lanes of road. It is a highway, but, you know, I don't want to give an impression that it's a busy highway like, Route 66. But it's officially a highway. and then a dirt berm, and then the edge of the cliff. And there was a computer reading that said they clocked the car at 90 miles an hour going over. But that can't be true.
Well, because they stopped, yeah.
Yeah, she was stopped. And a car with that much weight on board and that big a car could not get up to 90 miles an hour in 70 feet, which is how long she drove from the where she was parked to where the cliff would have been. So what I believe happened, what I believe they'll determine, is that the car, the wheels continued to turn on the way down, and that's why the computer reading got high.
Got so high, right. That makes sense.
Yeah. So this beautiful family, and by the way, the law enforcement has a term for something like this. It's called a family annihilator. And there, you know, we've seen these kinds of cases, not one quite like this, but, you know, this is not an unusual thing where a stressed out parent goes crazy and takes out a whole family. And in this kind of case, there's no coming back from this. And also, I mean, you know, if somebody had gotten thrown from the car and not taken out into the ocean, maybe somebody could have survived. You know, there was that case
right.
in Hawaii of the two sisters who
yes,
were seen fighting. And, yes, and they went over, I believe it was 200 feet. One died, the driver lived, and, you know, but they were rescued very quickly. So now we don't know if these children and the two women died of blunt force or from drowning. The authorities know that by now, but they're not saying. So
will they eventually say? I'm assuming.
Oh, yes, they will.
Okay.
The sheriff has said everything will be revealed in this case because everyone's dead and there's no reason to protect any privacy here. So,
okay.
you know, they're just, you know, what it means is that they're testing all of the bodies for pharmaceuticals and for
right.
other drugs and alcohol, which I don't think they'll find, but they may find some drugs because it seems like at least Jennifer had a little anger issue and maybe she was off her meds.
So do we have any, when I say we, I'm talking about you, can you offer up an opinion? Do you think, like you said earlier, it was, oh my God, you kids are driving me nuts and she'd lost her nut and did what she did? Or do you think this was planned? I mean, these women were not good women. They were horrible to these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, from what I've read, I could see them doing something this evil. What are your thoughts?
Well, that remains to be, you know, I'm not convinced either way yet. But here's the dark side, and you will not find any of their friends who will admit to this because they all think these are the Earth Mothers. And, you know, these are, if you go to YouTube and you look on their videos, They have the most life-affirming view of the world. They went on trips together. They, all six kids. This was a wolf pack.
Mm-hmm.
And the moms were just so happy to be with these kids. And they would go around singing music. And it was like a little Von Trapp family. And they would have signs that said free hugs, and they would all dress alike, and love is always beautiful, and they would preach Mother Earth and, you know, all these kind of great hippie idea deals.
Mm-hmm.
And so their friends are completely in denial that there was this other side. But the people who know about the other side are always the neighbors. There were 12
right.
instances where neighbors, and in fact, as recently as just days before, but dating back to when the two women only had three kids, there were repeated instances of the children being beaten almost waterboarded, heads held underwater, punched with fists, with belts, whipped with belts, the kind of thing that is way beyond spanking a kid on the butt for being naughty.
Right.
But there was also a willful withholding of food. And there was one example where one of the neighbors said one of the children, a girl, fell out or jumped out of a second-story window and into some bushes and ran to his house, and she said, please, please help me, help me. And she was missing her two front teeth, mm-hmm. covered in shrubbery, and he took her inside and said, "What, you know, what's happening with that?" And she said, "They're beating me, they're not feeding us, you have to do something." And these kids reached out to the in the only way they could. And
right.
Over and over, when there were these kinds of reports, the Children's Protective Services, whatever state they were in, and we're talking about from Minnesota to Oregon to Washington, they would report to the authorities. The authorities would come out, and the kids would stand in a line shivering and saying, "Oh, everything's fine. No, we love our moms." So that was going on. And yet when they documented, they took photos of this one kid who was bruised from head to toe. And it was, well, she fell down some stairs. Oh, she's so clumsy. And they'd take the child aside and the child would say, "Yeah, I fell down some stairs." One of the things that was one of the worst examples, and I think this was in Minnesota, so we're talking about maybe 7 years ago, one of the girls, and by the way, just to finish a thought, I'm sorry,
okay.
The girl who was missing her two front teeth, she looked like she was 7 years old, and the mothers, when the neighbor went over there the next day to ask what's going on, they told the neighbor that the girl was 12 years old and she's just going through some stages, you know, don't pay attention, it's just puberty. But she was actually 16. That's how starved she was. So, okay, back then to Minnesota, where one of the girls suffered bruises and abrasions that a teacher noticed. And mm-hmm. so when they reported that, she said, "Oh, yes, my mother, Jennifer, beat me, and then she held my head underwater." So they bring charges against her, and the mothers say, "Oh, no, you know, she's lying again. It wasn't Jennifer, it was Sarah. Sarah took the blame for it," even though the kid said, no, it was Jennifer.
Sarah got
a 90-day prison sentence, jail sentence,
mm-hmm.
that was suspended because she had never had any complaints before. So, you know, everyone went on their merry way. Meanwhile, the kids are divided. Some supported their sister and some supported their moms.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always this kind of dark cloud. Now, the other thing is after the photo of Devante and the cop went around the world, Jennifer said, "Oh, he's being bullied in school. We're pulling him out of school. We're going to homeschool these kids." And Sarah always worked at Kohl's.
Mm-hmm.
In whatever state she was in, she always went to work. Jennifer was the one hands-on,
literally, who
took care of the kids all day and was supposed to be homeschooling them. But they never registered for homeschool. And you have to do that when you're a homeschooler. You have to tell the county you're in, and you have to get permission, and there's a curriculum that you have to follow.
Exactly.
That was
right.
never, ever done. never done. And so, you know, there's a lot to be looked at here.
Really quickly. To me, when you say this, it's obvious, my opinion, that the kids were showing up with injuries, and people were starting to ask questions. So, hey, let's pull them out and homeschool them. Just like I said at the beginning, this is a certain type of evil.
Let's pull them out. Let's go to another county. Let's go to another state.
Right.
And here's the thing that is so frustrating is that states can barely keep track of abusive families within a state, but there's no budget for doing that from state to state to state.
Mm-hmm.
So you get away with it.
Bad. They've got to fix that. I mean, my God, we can track serial killers. We should be able to track abusers of children. What can you tell us about these two women? It seems like two evil beings attracted each other and just came together and created this den of hatred and abuse. What do we know about their backgrounds?
I don't think it was that way. I think they were, for most of the time, I think they were just loving, loving, loving parents who were, by the way, estranged from their families, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
They were both raised in rural South Dakota, and they met as students at Northern State University, and they were taking teaching classes. Then they moved to Alexandria, Minnesota, which is northeast of Minneapolis, and that's where they said they were. That's apparently where they got married, or who knows where they got married. But that's at some point, I'm assuming they got married to be able to adopt the children. There were two sets of children that they got. All the kids came from Texas. And they, here's what I just found out, is that the second group of children, which would be Devante, Jeremiah, and Sierra in 2009, were taken from a Houston family, and all three kids had the same mom, and they had, different dads. And mom was a drug addict and lost custody of the kids. The kids went into foster care. One of the paternal aunts who worked in a hospital said, hey, I will take these kids. And she got a 5-bedroom house to be able to take them. And there is an older son, too, who was a real truant and a problem, and he's in jail now for robbery.
Oh, dear.
So,
Why didn't the aunt get them?
The aunt got them for a while. So, everything was groovy. And then there was a court order not to let the mom anywhere near the kids. And on one occasion, the aunt had to go out and run an errand. So she left the kids at home and she called their mom and said, hey, can you come over and take care of their dinner? And mom said, sure. And that was just when a Texas Child Protective Services person popped in and said, you're not supposed to be here. And they yanked the kids back and put them out on the foster path again. And now this aunt is really heartbroken and upset.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine.
Yeah. Because, you know, she had the kids, but she made a mistake. She shouldn't have done that, and she made a mistake. Mm-hmm. And now the mother, the drug addict mom, knows that three of her children are dead and one is in jail. So now where do the other three kids came from? I mean, you look at the kids and you can see three are lighter black and three are darker black. So I guess that's how it divides, but the three that were from 2000 that were adopted in 2006, I don't know their backstory about how they came into the foster system. But you know, you see a family, a gay family, taking in foster kids of a different race, and you just want to cheer. You just want to say that is the best thing I've ever seen. I'm wishing them all the best.
They have everybody behind them.
Yeah, the state of Texas paid them something like $2,000 a month. But, you know, that's not that much money for six strapping teenagers and, plus two moms. And one mom is a, you know, shop girl who works at Kohl's. You don't make a lot of money doing that.
Right.
One of the things that they impressed upon these kids, and by the way, they would not let the kids deal with other neighbors or other friends. The kids were their own friends. There were no visitors to the house. There were no people in their lives outside of the mother's protective eye. Now, sometimes they would go to, you know, Earth Day gatherings and that kind of, you know, fairs and the music festivals. And there was a lot of music in these kids' lives. Mm-hmm. And on one occasion, two of the kids kind of broke loose and went off exploring and came back eating food. And one of the mothers, I think it was Sarah this time, was so angry that she grabbed the food because she didn't bring enough food for everyone. So she wouldn't let her eat the food that someone had given her. And she yanked her arm so hard that it left a bruise that went through the whole color, the whole rainbow of colors for a week. So that's just odd. It's just odd that that would happen. But, there was another example of when they were driving from Sarah had come out to Oregon to look for a job at Kohl's. And Jennifer and the six kids were driving across from Minnesota to come to there. And somewhere, I think it was Montana, their car broke down. And so while it was going to be fixed, somebody, some kind person said, listen, let me, give you guys a ride. And he and his wife rented a trailer and gave the family a ride to Spokane.
Wow.
And for the whole 3-hour drive, Jennifer wouldn't stop talking. She just talked about, we need a new start, we need a fresh start, and just wouldn't shut up. And he just thought it was very, very odd. And when he heard about this case, about the deaths of all of them, he said to his wife, you know, I had a funny feeling about these people. So, you know, for what that's worth, some of the people on the internet are protective of them, but I think you have to give more freedom to the people who saw these children begging for food and for help.
Right. You telling me this, it numbs me from head to toe. We're talking with Donna Kaufman about the Hart family and the two women. They were married. They took in six African American foster kids. And like you said, they were older. Everybody was cheering them on. We all wanted them to succeed. And instead, they end up being brutally murdered in a terrible way by going off a cliff in their minivan. Now, Donna, you said earlier you didn't think they started out like this. I don't know. I don't think this is something that you can just become, because it is so dark and evil. Holding back food, beating a child, there's something in the very beginning was wrong with these two women, I think, but we can't really say for sure. We can only, I think, if I'm not mistaken, and correct me, we can only go by the first report of child abuse. That's when we see this start. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, there's child abuse going back years. And at the same time, there's all these hopeful signs. They've recorded an album, and it's called Youth Music Empowerment. And if you go to soundcloud.com/youth music empowerment, you will see something like 8 songs that are professionally recorded.
That's great.
And
they're
called, some of the titles are Tribe and Friends Are Forever and Sacred Land and Wolfpack and Heart and Smiley and Good Things Coming, and they're hopeful and life affirming, and you know the kids are all singing, and there are videos, so you can't imagine that there's anything amiss. But obviously there were two sides here.
Big time two sides. I always wonder when there is abuse like this, how both of them can think it's okay. You would hope that one adult would step in and say, this is wrong, I'm taking the kids, you get help, bye-bye. Do you think we're going to find out any mental health records now that they're all dead? Is there any laws that apply to their privacy at all? I'm hoping we'll find out more so we can find out how to prevent something like this from happening again.
Well, I don't know who would advocate on their behalf. Because if it's true that their families have nothing to do with them, you know, that's their...
Right.
But the question is, what are they going to do with the bodies? You know, who's going to claim these bodies? The parents of the two women would seemingly get, you know, the bill or the, order to cremate or whatever.
Right.
Those are the kinds of things you look at in a real prosaic kind of way. Something has to be dealt with here. By the way, there's like they spent so much money, not that anyone would be billed, but because this is part of what goes with law enforcement.
Right.
But there have been search teams from so many communities and drones and planes and divers, and you know there's really all stops are out to try to find these last two bodies and
right.
to try to figure it out. But I whether or not we're going to find out their possible mental issues, did they see doctors? Did they, you know, have prescriptions of medicines, and were they taking medicines on a regular basis? I'm talking about the parents. But you know, I mean, if you've ever been around rageaholics, it just kind of comes up out of nowhere, and then they apologize like crazy, and you know, that's just how it is for a lot of people who live with people who are,
live with these
rageaholics.
Right. You deal with it the best you can, and you walk on eggshells constantly. I wonder also, again, there are so many theories that we could just throw out there with absolutely nothing to back them up. But I wonder if something happened that triggered this as far as maybe the authorities were closing in. Maybe somebody somewhere made a connection that these women were jumping from county to county to state to avoid the abuse charges. Maybe there was something along those lines that made
it trigger. You're absolutely right, because on the 23rd, which would have been so the 25th is Sunday when she was in the Safeway, so Friday the 23rd, the neighbor called CPS and said, hey, you know, you got to do something. This kid is being starved and this family is screwy and there's danger over there. Devontae kept coming over. You know, first he would come over and say, do you have some, you know, food? Can I have some bread? Can I have some, you know, peanut butter? And then he would say, I need a case of peanut butter because he's going to bring it back
baby.
Yeah, I mean, he was like, and then it was like 3 times a day, and then he'd say, just put it by the fence so no one finds out. And it's just like, okay, I've got to call CPS. This is it.
Yes.
So the officials came by, and no one was home. They left a card. And then Jennifer came home, but she didn't answer the door. So there's a record of the of CPS coming by and saying, you know, we tried to, we knocked at the door. We saw the car there, but no one answered. And then somewhere after that, the family vanishes, and CPS went back on Monday and on Tuesday to try to make contact, but didn't. I guess the moms figured the walls are closing in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, here's a little thing. On the 26th, which is the day that the car was found, a friend of Sarah's called 911 requesting a welfare check because she had received a text from Sarah saying that she was sick. She was unable to come out. Maybe I'm not sure if it was a work friend saying, I can't go to work. She may need to see a doctor or go to the hospital. But when the friend tried to call her, the phone was dead. And, you know, she didn't know what happened. So she called 911 and reported that. So by that time, the family was on the road to wherever. So
that is interesting.
Yeah.
I hope we get some answers, Donna. And I'll tell you, if anybody can find them, it will be you. So now we're just in a holding pattern until they can find the other two bodies. Find out if maybe the kids were drugged, maybe the parents were drunk. Like you said, I don't think so. I think you're right.
They're at the mercy of whoever is the driver. But
yes.
What kind of parent goes off on a, 600 mile drive and doesn't say, okay, everybody, put on your seatbelts? Isn't that the first thing you do before you start the car? Everybody in this car, put on your seatbelts. And yet none of them had seatbelts. So what was the typical, who in their community of friends or whatever, acquaintances, knows, is this something that they would normally do, put on seat belts, or were they, these are women who thumbed their nose at authority. Maybe that was another way of doing it.
Well, it certainly ensured that they died, that all the children died. And like I said, this is just a certain type of evil. And the sad thing is it could have been prevented if the authorities had been able to zero in and see what was going on. Now it seems obvious, though, Donna, doesn't it? To me, it's like, oh, my God, someone starves their kid and uses food as punishment. I'm sorry. End of story. Kid leaves. That person's crazy. But
no, but they did that. They did. They reported them. They reported them over and over. So what are you going to do if, you know, when you get out there, the kids lie? I really think everyone is so quick to blame CPS and, we're going to sue, and maybe that's the plot of the aunt, you know, maybe she's looking to file a lawsuit or something like that. But the point is, there were a lot of people trying to help, and these crafty women just got around it and had their own way of doing things. And the kids suffered. Yeah, they knew how to work it, exactly.
Donna Kaufman, tell us what else is going on in your life. What are you working on? What can we expect from you?
Well, I'm working on another book with Dr. Wecht, and it's going to be done soon. And we look forward to getting on your show to talk about it when it comes out. I hope it will be, later this year. And it's going to be a goodie.
Plenty to keep you busy. So where can somebody pick up the final exams, True Crime Cases of Sarah Wecht, that you co-wrote with Dr. Wecht? Where can somebody find that book?
Amazon or Planet and Rule, which is our publisher. And it's a really good book. I mean, it's
set
in there, if I might say so myself.
It's not egotistical. It's true. I'll say it. It's a great book, everybody. You should pick it up. There's no excuse for you not to have this book if you love true crime, because it is amazing.
Exactly.
There we go.
Because they're really twisty, weird cases.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the one that people will know about is the Jessica Lunsford case of the girl who was in Florida. So I'm the one who, you know, Dr. Wecht has done personally performed 20,000 autopsies and consulted on another 40,000. And I'm the one who picks the cases. So I always look for the weirdest, most twisty kinds of cases that you can imagine.
Right.
And so
you do a good job of that.
Yeah.
You do a great job.
I have
a lot to choose from.
To choose from.
Yes, you do. And let's give a shout out to Dr. Wecht for what he did in the Rebecca Zahow case. That was fantastic. Of course, the jury came back, the majority of the jury came back saying that Adam Shacknight was responsible basically for the death of Rebecca Zahow. She did not kill herself. And Dr. Wecht was quite Rebecca's champion. So when you see Dr. Wecht,
well,
thank you.
That's a very debatable case, and it's not over, and there will be an appeal. I think there are really good appellate issues, and so that's how it goes. That's the adversarial system. He testified. It was a civil case, but it was really a murder case.
Right.
But in that case, I will have to say the attorneys were just, you know, they shouldn't have. They were both out to sea. Both sides had civil attorneys trying to do a murder case, and they were over their heads.
Well, hopefully there might be a new sheriff. There might be a new sheriff in town. There's an election, and the person running against the current sheriff said he would reopen the case if he is elected. So let's hope that happens.
Well,
okay,
I don't necessarily share that opinion.
You don't?
I will say no. And the one that I also am following, of course, you know, this is Cosby case in.
Oh, yes. Let's talk just briefly because I want to have you on another show about that.
Yeah,
but
we'll do another show. This is a much, much different case than what we saw before.
Yes.
Very, very interesting. And I'm very up to the minute on that, so we can talk about it more.
We'll have you on as soon as that goes to the jury, and we'll see what happens with that. Donna Kaufman, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and good luck with your book with Dr. Wecht. Give him our best, and we'll have you
on
again.
I will. He's the greatest.
He is the greatest. We'll have you on again real soon to talk about Bill Cosby, okay?
Thank you so much, Tricia. All the best.
Take care now. You too now.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Donna Kaufman, she has so much damn energy, I swear. I feel like I need to take a nap for her. It's very strange. I'll talk to my shrink about it. Okay, we are going to wrap up Web Sleuths Radio with a very upbeat story. And it involves one of our dear friends, Dr. Lillian Glass, and it's all about reinventing Rosalie. Here we go.
We're talking with Lillian Glass, Dr. Lillian Glass.
Yes.
We know her as the world-renowned body language expert, but now she is a producer and director of already an award-winning documentary about her mother, who is over 100 years old, and it's called Reinventing Rosalie. And Dr. Glass, you're here tonight not as a doctor, but as a daughter and a director and a producer.
Exactly.
Tell us about Reinventing Rosalie. It just sounds fascinating.
Oh, it's something that I think people have really resonated with. It's a film about hope. It's also a film that says it's never too late to live your dream and that you can do things at any age. And, you know, we live in a world right now where there's so much confusion and people don't know what to do with their lives, and people are being laid off or fired or getting divorced or all different transitions in their lives. And this film shows you that no matter what happens to you, it's never too late to do something you've never done before. And particularly with Rosalie, she started out life kind of, you know, happy child, nice family, good parents that loved her a lot. And at 18, she was an entrepreneur. She had her own business. She had 10 women working for her making men's shirts, and she sold them to different stores around Poland. And she did very, very well and was a budding entrepreneur businesswoman. And that was really way ahead of her time. And then she, you know, everything was going great, and she fell in love. Her husband was that she was married to for 60 years, ended up playing a song for her outside of her window. He was courting her, and she went out to see who is that man, and, you know, they fell in love. And
how romantic.
Yeah.
Nobody ever does that anymore. No, yeah, God, where are guys like that? Good Lord. Okay. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And then,
what a wonderful
then
life she had in the beginning.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. And then the war broke out, and it was quite tragic, and she ended up being a prisoner in a Siberian gulag in Russia, and she was kidnapped from Poland, and it was very tragic, and the film addresses that, and then it also talks about her journey to America and how she got here via Kazakhstan and, you know, some other places, and she then, you know, tried to live the average American life here and did what she could to survive. And then, you know, we saw she had a serious tragedy where my brother, her son, beloved son, was in a medical malpractice situation, and he ended up becoming a vegetable and dying from being intubated wrong. And
oh,
that
no.
was when she wanted to give up on life. She didn't want to live anymore. And,
I don't blame her.
It was, yeah, it was kind of almost the end for her. And then one day it was like a miracle happened. She says, you know, the two people I love the most are gone, and I'm going to live my life to the fullest. And she did. And at 86, she became an actress. At 90, she traveled the world, in her 90s, I should say. And at 94 was in a beauty pageant, Miss Congeniality. And then at 97 was in a Super Bowl commercial. 99 wrote a book, and 100 rode the sled dogs in Alaska.
Wow.
So she's like a, you know, a very wonderful testimony to all of us that we can change our world and the world by just living positively and doing what our hearts desires.
Well, and the documentary, and you, this has been a project of love for you for many years.
Yes.
The documentary called, it, I said the documentary has been a project of love for you for many years working on it.
No, it only happened for 9 months. I had
Are
no
you
idea.
Kidding?
Yeah,
I thought it was
kidding.
Like over like
oh,
5 years.
No, no, no.
Oh, my gosh.
It feels like 5 years. But
yeah, no, maybe that's
9
it.
9 months. I did this documentary 9 months. And how it came about is fascinating. Well, that's a good story for your audience. What had happened was one day Rosalie was wearing tight shoes. Her feet were tight, and she's complaining, my feet hurt. And I said, you know, kind of kidding around with her, I said, you're never happy unless your feet are happy. And she said, you know, I always say that. That's what I say. I said, of course that's what you say. Where do you think I got that? I said, in fact, I have about 100 of your sayings. I know every one of your sayings. She says, really? She says, oh, my goodness. She says, why don't we share this with people? I would like to write a book and have this for people to, you know, that also enjoy the sayings that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to do that. So we went and did that. And then my family doctor, who is, by the way, Dr. Robert Huizinga, the doctor on The Biggest Loser, and he's a great guy. And he said, you know, I gave him one of Rosalie's books because one of the things she wrote in there was for him. She has a picture taken with him in the book. And it says, you know, any illness can be cured if you see a doctor regularly, you know, and that's quickly, regularly. So she kind of put that, one of her words of wisdom. And he says, you know, you should do a documentary on her. And I said, what? And he goes, yeah, that would be amazing. I said, but how do you do that? Do you know anybody? He goes, you'll figure it out. You could do anything. I said, me? So I said, oh, my God. So that kind of, what he said kind of resonated in my head, and I didn't know what to do, where to turn. So I used to be a professor at the University of Southern California, USC, and they have the top film school in the country. So I contacted the head of the film school to find out what can I do. And he was gracious enough to spend hours and hours with me because I was a professor, so it was kind of like one professor to the next. And he, like, taught me so much and everything I wanted to know. And, well, not everything, but he taught me a lot and where to go, what to do, what to join. And this this, he gave me the names of three directors. He says, yeah, you need a director. And so the first director I contacted on his recommendation was too busy, wasn't available. The second director was, had a different vision. You know, he saw mm-hmm. it completely differently than I did. And the third director, is kind of out of the mouth of babes, was a student, just graduated from USC Film School, and he had done a documentary actually on his father in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a lovely boy, and he said to me, you know, Dr. Glass, you could be a director with your personality and your vision. Why don't you direct it? Like, okay, I'm a director. So I went and I got every book I could out from Amazon on mm-hmm. directing and how to direct. And I got, I studied it and how to do camera angles and this. And then I figured, okay, now I'm a director. I need to get a cameraman. What do I do?
Oh, my
so
God.
I went to Sammy's Camera Shop in mm-hmm. L.A. And, you know, I went and I went to the top because I figured if you go to the camera store, that people buy cameras or materials, you know, the
right.
equipment that they needed. So I went there and somebody gave me the name of this wonderful cinematographer. We met mm-hmm. and it was perfect. And he came to Alaska with me and did the shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's kind of how it all started. And then because I was a director now, I wanted to read everything I could and see movies and about directing. And there was a movie that was just kind of, had come out about Cecil B. DeMille.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, of course, the director of all time, the best director.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went to see this movie. And it could have been a boring movie, but the editor made this movie so beautiful. So I contacted the editor. I waited till all the credits, and I got the name of the editor, and I tracked him down like you do on Web Sleuth.
He couldn't hide
and,
from you.
Like you. That's kind of your, I'm speaking your language now.
Yeah, exactly.
And I contacted him, and we just did this beautiful film together, this, you know, and then got the person who did the music. Oh, it's just, I have to say, it's a best thing I've done in my life. It's beautiful.
That is, and that's
it's
amazing.
It's touched my heart. It's touched my heart.
Well, and plus, now, to everybody listening, what Dr. Glass told us about the documentary, that those are just the headlines. You have to see this show to understand exactly how in-depth Rosalie, her mother's life really is and how amazing it is. And it will give you hope because
yeah.
a lot of people... You know, I'm going to be hitting 60 this year, and I started feeling like, ooh, literally feeling like my life was over. I really couldn't do much. And then I read about Rosalie, and it's such an inspiration. But now let's talk about the fact that this documentary, Reinventing Rosalie, has already won an award. And it's
yeah,
not even finished editing. What's the deal?
It's amazing. Well, first of all, it's also starting to get into all these festivals. It got into this Miami festival. So it got accepted there. To get into a festival is a huge thing, by the way. You know, you see, oh, so-and-so is playing it. So if you get into a festival, it's, you know, they've got thousands of people competing with their
right.
films. And so just the fact that they choose you to be in the festival is a big deal. So you
mm-hmm.
should be happy with that, you know.
Yeah.
So we've gotten into quite a few. We got into a Russian film festival. We got into a Moroccan film festival. We got into the Manhattan Film Festival, and it got into the L.A., the Jewish L.A. Film Festival. And in the Jewish L.A. Film Festival, that's the 26th of
mm-hmm.
April, so anybody from L.A. can come see it, and it's at 7:30 at night. And it's, at that festival, Gloria Allred's film was going to be shown a day before ours,
mm-hmm.
and let's see, Sammy Davis Jr., they did a whole film on him, a whole biography, documentary on him. He's going,
mm-hmm.
his film is going to be shown. And so it's quite, going to be quite an event. And so I'm honored, you know, just to be in that environment.
Amazing company, yes.
Yeah, and to have this film
But what award did you win? That's just amazing.
Oh, so then, out of the blue, we got an award. It's for Best Inspirational Film from the Los Angeles Film Association. And that was such an honor. We were just beside ourselves because that's just beautiful, beautiful that we got. And we just found out we got into the Vero Beach Film Festival. And so now it's festival time. And I'm going to Cannes Film Festival to try to sell the film. So
That'd be great.
Try to see if, you know, somebody can knock on doors like, hey.
You need to get into the Sundance Film Festival because that's where I live.
Oh, yeah, because that's, as I said, easier said than done.
Oh, yes,
there's thousands
absolutely.
And thousands of people, and, you know, and we'll try everything. We'll try everything. We'll try as many festivals. And that costs money. I mean, you think you just enter it, but, my God, they have entry fees and so many. I mean, I don't even want to talk about the money that I spent on this film so far, but that's why I try to do a little Indiegogo crowd.
Right. And let's talk about that, okay? Mm-hmm. Because you did put all the money in this film. And you still need more. And I want to remind everybody.
Every day I realized, oh, my God, I've got to do this. I've got to do this. It's not, you know, I thought I was finished. I thought, okay, yeah, I'll finance it. Okay, so what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll pay some.
But I want to remind everybody, Dr. Glass, how much you have given back to communities, to society, with all of your free work that you have done, all of your volunteer work, helping a lot of people on Web Sleuth. So, and I've always said this, if everybody got together and gave $5, I mean, 20,000 people giving $5 could make all the difference in the world.
All the difference in the world.
And so where can we go donate for you?
All you have to do is go to Indiegogo and call and write down Reinventing Rosalie. So you just say Indiegogo Reinventing Rosalie. That's Indiegogo.
Mm-hmm.
And then the name of the film is Reinventing Rosalie. And that will be so helpful. Whatever you can donate, we're grateful. We don't care. And there's some perks there that you might like. So you donate more, you get some good perks. But
perfect.
You know, there's a lot of good things.
Oh, again, this Reinventing Rosalie has also shown you that you can have this wonderful, fulfilling career and kind of at a comment made by somebody you respect, you can turn right around and do something totally different.
Completely.
That is just as amazing and incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Both you and your mother, Rosalie, are inspirations to everybody.
Thank you.
So everybody, and this includes myself, who sit there and go, I can't do anything. You're wrong. You're absolutely
sure,
wrong.
Anything. And, you know, look, I'm not saying that, you know, your first time out of the box is going to succeed. You know, I'm just so grateful that at least people are starting to love this film. I mean, I've worked so hard on it, and many sleepless nights, like a whole year or a whole 9 months, I should say, of sleep. You know, researching, studying, just taking all of my skill sets. So I think the lesson that I can give to people is take your skill sets and use them how you see it. So my skill sets are research. I'm a great researcher, and that's what I've, you know, done all my life, you know, through researching material for books or researching body language or researching for being an expert witness. So I have that skill set. Then another skill set that I have is knowing how to read people, body language. So that was invaluable in being a director and in analyzing films and analyzing which scenes you want. I mean, that couldn't have been better. And then my other skill set is I'm very tenacious. You know, I will stop at nothing to make it happen, go to the ends of the earth to get the right thing for the right issue. And or situation, I should say. And so those three skill sets did me very well in this new venture. And I guess it's kind of the same thing where – if let's just take you, Trish. Now, you're obviously very well spoken, and you have such a great warmth and sensibility, and
thank you.
And you involve people. So I think the next step you know, if I had to say, what would you like to, I could see you having your own television show.
Oh,
being,
wow.
You know, very visible, but those are your skill sets, you see.
Right.
Not everybody can do that. They can want to do it, but
mm-hmm.
you have the smoothness, the graciousness, the,
oh,
the intelligence, and the knowledge in your field. So I think, you know, you take that skill set and you try something, you know, completely different. And then maybe you might even want to be a detective because you're so
there
good
you
at
go.
Stuff. So you know, maybe you'll get a license. You know, I'm just using you as an example.
Sure, right,
you know,
right.
Like you have certain skill sets. You know, you're tenacious. You're a digger. You go get stuff. You know, you
mm-hmm.
find stuff, the core of things, and you're well-spoken. So if you were in a, let's say, a private detective, you would do extremely well to make
oh,
some money
you.
On the side and to be, you see what I'm saying? So people,
right.
I mean, there are other people that are very methodical and there are people that are, you know, that would be great at something. So the key is to take your skill sets and then use them to your advantage.
Exactly. Just like you did. Exactly
yeah.
like you did. Oh,
yeah,
this is
yeah.
so exciting. So
yeah.
what is the plan to where one day, and I hope it's very, very soon, I can go to Netflix or I can go to a movie
oh,
theater and
so.
See Reinventing Rosalie.
Yes,
how does
I'm
that
trying,
come about?
I have no idea. I'm doing everything by the seat of my pants. But I think what it is I go to Cannes and I figure out what to do there. Just like
mm-hmm.
I have no idea what to do, how to do a film. So
gotcha.
I figured it out. So now I'm just going to try to figure out how to sell it and how to what to do and who wants it.
So you need a distributor. You're trying to get a distributor.
Yeah, I need
who
a
will...
distributor for sure.
Right.
Need, you know, it would be nice to, you know, if one of your fans from Netflix was listening, that'd be great. But yeah,
there you go.
That's this kind of the next step.
Perfect.
Kind of the next step is let's get it out in the world. And
perfect for Netflix,
and
I think.
Do it. Yeah, I would think so. But, you know, again, you never know. About
mm-hmm.
anything. I mean, we've certainly seen people on television. We're going, how did that happen?
How the hell did that piece of baloney get up there? I know. And this is good stuff. This is good
yeah,
stuff
this
that
is,
needs
this
to be
is
out
something
there.
That will, I think, everybody will see. It's not just a film about an old woman that, you know, did something with her life. I mean, that's just
mm-hmm.
part of it. It's something that, because it really is about, hey, I can relate to this, and I think that's where what people are relating to.
Mm-hmm.
Even the trailer. If anybody wants to see the trailer, go to Vimeo and put in Reinventing Rosalie, and you'll
okay.
see the trailer at Vimeo. And or just type in the internet Reinventing Rosalie trailer,
mm-hmm.
and or go to our website. It's on our website www.reinventingrosalie. And
okay.
you'll see some incredible, you know, you'll just see something that will very much touch your heart
mm-hmm.
and I think your life. And it's really about each individual that can help, that can be enhanced. And, you know, sometimes we need a movie that is inspirational instead of all the, you know.
Absolutely.
All
the,
that isn't.
Yeah. That isn't inspirational. And
right.
the fact that this is a true story and it is
yes.
an amazing story. And Rosalie is still going strong. Is she still going on auditions?
Yeah, as of, let's see, a month ago, right? But right
mm-hmm.
now we're getting, you know, really geared for travel and really geared for these festivals. And so she's going to be, we're going to be at the LA Jewish Festival together. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, she's going to get all dressed up and
oh, she looks
and,
so cute when she gets
oh,
dressed
yeah.
up. She's so
oh,
darling.
Adorable. Yeah, wear little evening gowns.
Oh, how fun.
You know, and
oh,
when
gosh.
You go to Cannes, you have to wear all these little evening gowns. So she's
absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, I will definitely put out links to your website, to the the fundraiser,
awesome.
And to the trailer,
Indiegogo,
all of it. All
yeah.
of it. We'll get it out there as best we can. And Dr.
Oh,
Glass.
Oh, you're so great. You're so great.
Well,
and I'm so much a fan of yours. You know.
Well, thank
amazing.
You. But it's just a very small way of me to say thank you to you for all that you have done. And I want you to give Rosalie my love and everybody on WebSleuth. And we'll even have a thread started for you so people can comment.
Oh, that'd be great.
And talk.
I love it. Yeah, let them know. Let me know what you think of the trailer. And
absolutely.
We'll get it.
We'll get it up
all
there.
All right. Wonderful.
Thank you, Dr. Glass.
Thank you so much. My pleasure. Okay.
You take care now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Pretty much a jam-packed Web Sleuths podcast for you. And next week, going to be good. It's always good. We always have the great guests on. And as long as they keep talking, it's a great show. Hey, guess what? I get to go to CrimeCon thanks to some very generous friends who are making it possible for me. Thank you very much. CrimeCon 2018, it's the second year. And speaking of jam-packed, that place is going to be rocking with true crime. Now, I will be doing some live reports from CrimeCon 18, and I'm going to try and find out the stuff that nobody bothers to find out, like who hates who pretends to like somebody but they really don't, maybe even find out who's having affairs. I don't know. And in between that, I'll get in some true crime stuff as well. CrimeCon 18, more Web Sleuths podcast, and it all happens at one place. That's websleuths.com. We'll see you there. Take care. Bye-bye.